Is Rick on?
It looks like it, yeah. I'm not sure if the... Oh, yep, his audio is there.
Okay, good. All right, let's convene the meeting. This is the August 23rd, 2021 PUD Commission meeting, virtual, of course. And so we're called to order. First item is approval of the consent agenda. We've got a pretty short one this time. Minutes of previous meetings, claim vouchers, and payroll vouchers. Do I have a motion?
I move that we accept the consent agenda.
I'll second that motion.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda for August 23rd, 2021. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right. Next item is agenda revisions. We've got a pretty long agenda here today, so I would propose taking the line of credit discussion and postponing that to the next meeting. So that one may go long, so we probably need more time to do that. Any objection to doing that?
No, sir.
No.
Okay, good.
I have one agenda item or issue, if I may. The public comments are, it looks like they're coming after the executive session. Do we want to offer at the end of the meeting, before the executive session, public comments for people that want to comment on something they've heard so they may don't have to sit around for whatever it takes us to do the executive session?
Yeah, that's I think that's a good suggestion. We'll do that. We'll move public comments before the executive session.
Will, I've got one more thing here. Ted Wright, who on item F is scheduled to join us, but maybe not till 2:15 or a little bit later. So we'll just play that one by ear. If he comes on by two, if he's on when we're ready to get to him, that's fine. If he's not, maybe we'll move down to H and take care of that while we're waiting for him.
Okay, good. Is that going to fit in? We got Mathias before and after Ted.
Yes. Yeah, we'll just wait on Mathias will give the first one, E, on energy efficient acquisitions. But then we'll wait for Ted before Mathias does G.
Okay, and we may move H up there. Okay.
Right.
Okay, we're down to comments from the public. Sean, do we have any?
Nothing in the chat, Will, but if anybody from the public would like to make a comment, now would be the time. I have one more person from the public joining here. Will, I can ask them to.
Okay.
Hi, Jan. I see that you just joined and we're at the comments from the public section. If you'd like to make a comment, please let me know. Hearing none, Will.
Okay, good. All right, we'll move on to business items. Our first item is acceptance memo for completion for bid number 211004. That's for $90,106 with Brunch and Brunch Construction, Inc. for the Sail River to Snow Creek Transmission Road construction upgrades for utility access roads. It's near Highway 112 east of Neo Bay. That's Ben Phillips. Ben, are you on?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Excellent. So I'd like to present to you acceptance memo of completion to Brook and Brook. All work completed above the above reference contract with Brook and Brook Construction has been completed. It's recommended this work be accepted as complete. Project consisted of supplying and performing the clearing, widening, grading, and placement compaction of rock and culverts for utility road access in the vicinity of Highway 112. Milepost 0.08 to milepost 0.5, which is approximately 2 miles east of Neah Bay between Sail River and Snow Creek in Clallam County. Contractor started the project on July 7th of this year and completed it on August 6th for a total price of $90,106 with two change orders. The change order number one was for work that was originally planned to be a part of the project and bid with the project. After it was put out to bid, our crews came back to us and said, or excuse me, before it was put out to bid, our crews came to us and said, hey, no, we can do that work. So we went ahead and took it off the bid so that our guys could do it to save money. And then after it was bid, our guys came back and changed their minds and requested that we go ahead and contract that work. So that was the first change order for $14,162. The second change order was for we had to build approximately 650-foot road that came down and ended with a pole right at the end of it. And originally we had planned access slash turnaround, which would be been if you're facing the pole on the left side of that pole. Terrain conditions didn't allow for that to be on that side. The contractor, thinking this was simply for a turnaround, ended up providing that turnaround to us about 200 feet back up the road. But it wasn't just for a turnaround. It also provides our crew the access to the pole from the side so they can boom up to the side of it without coming up underneath of the lines. So that change order was to create access to the right side of the pole where we could get over to the side of the pole, and that change order was for $3,877.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Ben. So who watches those projects? How did the contractor do that turnaround in the wrong location?
He just took it upon himself. Like I say, they assumed that it was only a turnaround and thought by moving it up the road that they were still giving us what they needed. We weren't actually consulted on that before they did it. But like I said, it wasn't just for turnaround. It was also for access to the pole from the side rather than directly underneath.
Okay, good. Thank you. Do we have a motion for this one?
I move that we accept the memo of completion for bid number 211004.
I'll second the motion.
Moved and seconded for acceptance of memo of completion for bid number 211004 for the Sail River to Snow Creek Transmission Road Construction Upgrades with Brunch and Brunch Construction, Inc., for a total contract cost of $90,106, including Washington State sales tax. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Ben. Our next item is Resolution 2207-21, adopting the district's charge card policy. Sean, I think you have that one.
I do. So Resolution 2207-21 amends the district's current charge card policy. And this is really just a simple housekeeping item. The only change to the policy is that we're adding a program called Payment Plus through U.S. Bank. Payment Plus allows the district to pay its participating vendors with our credit card, which generates a rebate on those purchases. And currently the rebate is about 1.59%. So normally when we receive an invoice from a vendor, we process it through accounts payable, and then we issue a check. This process would allow participating vendors to receive funds quicker through Payment Plus by accepting Visa. And then when the vendor does that, the district receives a cash rebate of about 1.5% for that transaction. We've been using this for a little bit now, and in the first quarter of this year, we got over $10,000 in that rebate. So it's very advantageous for us to do this, and that's the only change we're proposing to the policy. So staff recommends adopting Resolution 2207-21 as presented, which is adopting the district charge card policy, and then rescinding Resolution 2166-20. But I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, it sounds pretty good to me, but
no questions from me.
I'm fine.
Hey, do I have a motion on this one?
I move that we accept Resolution 2207-21, adopting the district's charge card policy.
I'll second that.
Moved and seconded to approve Resolution 2207-21, adopting the district's charge card policy. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Hey, thank you. Thanks, Sean. Our next item is Resolution 2208-21, authorizing the disposal of surplus property. Charlie, are you on?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Go for it.
All right. With this, just a simple request. We're asking you commissioners to authorize the disposal of surplus property. It consists of some various teller cash drawers and safes that are no longer needed and have an estimated surplus value of $450. We had some substation battery chargers, which are no longer needed due to being replaced during substation rebuilds, that have an estimated combined surplus value of $900. 52 security lights and 16 street lights that have become idle due to LED conversions in the field, and they have an estimated combined surplus value of $4,200. And finally, we have 26 aluminum equipment mounts that became obsolete once we migrated to using fiberglass equipment mounts for safety reasons, and they have an estimated surplus value of around $700. Total value of the surplus property is $6,250. Glad to take any questions.
Charlie, this is Rick.
Hey, Rick.
This is the first time I've, since I've been on board, that we've got rid of surplus property that I recall. Could you tell me how that works?
Yes, sir. Let's take the teller cash door. What we do, we have an annual surplus roundup. I send out emails to every department. This is, we actually have to do this according to state auditors. Any equipment or just anything that's sitting around the district is collecting dust or not being used, we like to put it out for either public surplus or put it on our govdeals.com to try to get some type of value out of it before it decreases, worsens value. So that's typically what we do. Most of this stuff has been around a while. It's old, and we kind of clear house once a year with each department to see what they want. They want to keep their stuff or get rid of it so we can put it on govdeals.com and try to keep everything fresh.
How does that work, Charlie? Is it open to the public?
And it is.
How does the public get noticed about it?
Yes, sir. I'll send out an email to all employees, and as well as it is a public website. We've been doing this for quite a few years now, and a lot of government agencies do. We picked up this idea from other PUDs who are using this site as well. So there's no actual notice that goes out to the public, but this is a website that's always available to the public.
Great. Thank you, Charlie.
You bet. Anyone else?
Hey, Charlie, I have a question. Is there a minimum amount of surplus disposal that you don't have to come to the board for a resolution?
There is. And typically we don't bother you guys with the smaller stuff, but being how this is our annual roundup and it was a good bit of stuff, I wanted you guys to be aware of what we were asking to get rid of. If it was just an old desk that got beat up, had a company number, we would not ask permission. You know, it just depends on the items and how much we're getting rid of. But
okay.
This is an annual deal, so I'll probably be doing this at least once a year with you guys just to let you know what we're gathering up and getting rid of.
Yeah, that's fine.
And the value of this is, you estimate, around $6,000?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I really hope we're going to get more than that. I really do hope we're going to get more than that for these items.
So, do we have a motion on disposal of surplus property?
I move that we accept Resolution 2208-21, authorizing the disposal of surplus property.
I'll second that.
And moved and seconded to approve Resolution 2208-21. Authorizing the disposal of surplus property which is no longer needed or is obsolete. The total estimated value of this surplus property is $6,250. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay, thank you, Dylan.
Okay, thanks. All right, we're moving down to item E, which is the 2020-2021 Energy Efficiency Acquisition. Mathaz? I don't see. Yeah, there he is.
Yeah, I'm here. Like Doug mentioned earlier, this my presentation is tied to an upcoming presentation with Ted Light here. So I will just give my brief sort of introduction, and then when Ted logs on around 2:15, we'll get to that. screen. Can everybody see that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I will be talking about our 2020-21 Energy Efficiency Acquisition. So this is related to the Energy Independence Act and the Conservation Potential Assessment that we did back in 2019. So I'm going to be talking about the 2020-21 Energy Independence Energy Efficiency Acquisition. Talk a little bit about the cost of that compliance and some additional benefits for the energy conservation programs that we offer. Then following Ted's presentation, I'm going to be asking the board to consider a resolution to adopt a 10-year savings potential and 2-year target for 2022-23 Energy Independence Act compliance period. So, at a board meeting, September 23rd, 2019, resolution number 2160-19, the board adopted an energy conservation target of 6,833 megawatt hours. Then we have sort of independently established, we have a strategic goal to overachieve that target by 20%, because we are allowed to, if we overachieve on the target, we're allowed to claim those savings in the future. So in essence, we have a conservation target for the 2-year period of 8,199 megawatt hours. And through June, we've already acquired 11,650 megawatt hours of energy savings in total. And that's from a mix of the 20% rollover energy savings that we've acquired in future bienniums that we can now claim in the current biennium. It also includes energy savings allocated to us from the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, or NEA, the acronym they use on the chart there. NEA is involved in regional energy efficiency efforts that sort of span outside of our service territory. And since Bonneville Power Administration is a direct funder on behalf of us, we get allocated energy savings from their work. So, currently we're going to meet our target easily. And in fact, while we're still running programs, we're holding off to invoice those claims to BPA so that we can claim the saving in the next biennium, since we already comfortably met both the EIA target as well as our own strategic target. Our own programmatic savings, I've just put together a pie chart so you can see where we're getting our savings. A lot of it comes from lighting, and when it says lighting here, I mean specifically residential lighting. That 18% of the total savings that we've acquired comes from the Simple Steps residential LED promotion that actually ended 2020. So we no longer pay for residential LED savings, but we've got a fair chunk of it in 2020. Also, in the commercial sector, which represents 38% of the total, most of that is in fact also LED lighting. Those programs aren't ending, though, until, essentially almost all commercial lighting is LED. Not included in this pie chart is distribution efficiency, appliance rebates, home electronics, and insulation. Technically we get a little bit of savings from those programs, but they're fractional percentages, less than 1%. So I thought it would just clutter up the chart to include those. But there's small pieces of a part of the puzzle from those programs as well. In terms of program costs, we're realizing those energy savings really cheap. The net cost is $19.79 per megawatt hour in energy savings. When I was looking at this chart here and this slide this morning, I noticed it was a slight error. You can see there on the bottom, it says net actual $11.91. You should just ignore that. That's from when I did this presentation some years ago. We used to subtract off energy efficiency incentive payments we get from Bonneville Power Administration when we calculated our costs, but we no longer do that because the funding we get from BPA we also pay for. So it kind of skews things a little bit to subtract that. So when I calculate the cost nowadays, it's just really raw incentive payments and then calculator over the energy savings of the measure life of the various incentive programs. And that, you know, about $20 a megawatt hour is well below our strategic target of requiring energy savings of $43 or less per megawatt hour. You can see here in the chart that perhaps the agricultural programs looks kind of small, or it looks kind of expensive. And that's just because that's really just one project that we did. You know, it's generally the approach I take to our programs is I try to, you know, run cheap and effective programs, but I also want to have mechanisms so all of our customers can participate. So that particular project was a tad expensive, but it's within BPA's program requirements, and on a net basis, it sort of still averages out to be very cheap. So in general, that's not, you know, what we promote or try to do.
So back to your pie chart, is that you've got those heating measures, is that ceiling ducts all the way up to ductless heat pumps? What's included in that?
That's exactly correct. It's ceiling ducts, heat pumps, like regular heat pumps, so PTCS heat pumps, really what we call it, which is a performance-tested comfort system, a heat pump design and installation standard that BPA has developed, as well as ductless heat pump. And duct ceiling is a really small percentage today, really. It's grouped in the heating measures, but we really probably only do 3 or 4 duct ceiling measures a year nowadays. So it's, you know, about evenly split between regular heat pumps and ductless heat pumps.
That does that include heat pumps that are more efficient replacement of existing heat pumps?
Yes, exactly. And that's, so, you know, we call it a heat pump program when we talk to our, or a heat pump rebate when we talk to our customers, but really what it is a heat pump upgrade program. We don't pay an incentive for just a regular heat pump. Rather, it needs to meet the performance tested comfort system standard in order to be eligible for an incentive, and that's what we pay for.
Thanks.
It's just easier to sell that to just call it a heat pump rebate instead of getting into the complication of what that upgrade means. Then in terms of additional benefit, actually we reduced, through these programs, reduced our system peak in 2020 by 1,000 kilowatt hours, and year to date we have a calculated system peak reduction of 372 kilowatt hours. And also through those efforts we reduced CO2 emissions in the region by 1,200 metric tons, and for 2020 and 2021 is 418 metric tons. Of course, you know, none of these numbers is really what drives our program. The reason we run our programs is for energy savings and because of the requirement under the Energy Independence Act. But it's really easy for me to calculate these numbers up based on the unit energy saving values that BPA and the Regional Technical Forum has calculated. So I figured, you know, since the Washington legislature shows interest in these things, I figure I might as well calculate them up and show them to you.
Matthias?
Yep.
I noticed we're way below what we did in 2020. I'm assuming that's because of penetration of conservation, and it's just getting harder and harder to get more kilowatt hours.
That's about correct. I mean, the big difference is actually residential LED lighting. You know, we ran those programs for many years, and they've been super strong, and they're just not included in 2021 going forward. You know, for all intents and purposes, we consider that market transformed, and it doesn't, you know, it wouldn't be fair for us to count those savings, and it would be waste of ratepayer money to pay for LEDs when there people are buying them anyways.
Thank you.
So, yeah, so to conclude, we're on track to meet and exceed our 2020-21 Energy Independence Act biennial target. We're still doing it, you know, very cheap. You know, while I'm here, you know, I should mention that my expectation is next biennium is going to be pretty cheap, too, because we still have some commercial LED lighting. But then beyond next biennium, which would be 22-23, that Ted is going to start talking about the potential assessment that we've done, you know, there's just not going to be LED lighting available, even in the commercial sector. And then beyond that, the reliance will be much heavier on those heating measures.
Nice job.
You're talking about a resolution there, but you want to save that till after Ted's presentation? Is
yes, exactly. I talk about a resolution here, but that's really a resolution to hopefully establish a potential and a target for the next biennium after Ted has sort of described how we came up with those numbers and values, and after you've had a chance to talk to him about that. So hopefully we can return to that when Ted logs in here in about 20 minutes or so.
Wow. Okay, so we'll rearrange the agenda a bit to accommodate that. We've heard no word from Ted. You're saying 20 minutes before he comes on?
Yeah, he told me that he felt comfortable saying that he'd be logged in by 2:15, and I haven't seen him here yet. He just had another meeting he had to attend to. I spoke to him earlier this morning, though, and everything seemed like he should work out.
Okay, well, let's move on to item H. We'll move it up and waiting for Ted. That's the Bonneville Power Administration's BPA's post-2028 contract discussion. The PPC/BPA meeting is tomorrow, so it may be a little premature, but we'll open that up for discussion.
Go ahead, Jim.
You can go, Rick. Go ahead.
One of the things that I've noticed during the meetings is that melded rates doesn't seem to be getting much traction. That's all I had, Jim.
Okay. I participated in the BPA QBR executive session and workshop, and some of the comments there kind of fold into this 2028 contract process. And notably, what was interesting is they reported out on cash on hand and so forth, and they reported that we're looking really good so far this year at $512 million cash in hand, reserves, which is about $200 million more than you would get into to hit a surcharge trigger on the power side. But one of the things, if you get into the numbers, what you realize is, one is they didn't spend $165 million in capital. It's not clear how that gets counted in that remaining that cash on hand. If you just took it as an amortization deduction, which they show that was about $37 million. Also, we have to keep in mind that about $112 million of that cash is actually rollover from last year when they had the summer heat wave down in California and Bonneville made a lot of money over a couple of weeks of period. So none of that's really nothing's much has changed to improve the situation, minor. But so when you start knocking all this stuff down, it's still okay, but it's not as rosy as they make it look like on their forecast for reserves at risk. The other thing that they talked about was that because of the in spite of the fact that mid-C prices for power are higher this year for a variety of reasons. The water levels or the flows on the Columbia and especially the Snake are really low. So the uncertainty around surplus power sales, if you will, secondary power, is up in the air. And so basically their BPA was saying that they're not really making that much money off of secondary sales simply because the water volumes are so low, and it's, so that's impacting that. So that sort of all plays into the financial situation that BPA is heading into. And that's the only meetings I've on this kind of thing that I participated in the last couple of weeks, and I'll be on the call tomorrow. Thanks.
Yeah, I just add one thing. Energy Northwest, we've got a workshop this week, and one of the agenda items is the extended power uprate of Columbia. The numbers indicate they can get another 170 megawatts out of Columbia with some extensive uprates of major equipment. And this would happen over numerous refueling outages and so on. The good news there is, of course, has to sell this project to Bonneville. This would go into the Tier 1 power available, and so it would free up more power for Bonneville to market, and it would be in line with their debate about joining the EIM, so there would be some revenue coming back from that.
The one positive here in this area is from one of the financial.
Somebody's talking. Do we have?
I think it's Jim, Will, but he's frozen.
Oh, I see.
Let me start again. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we'll hold off for a minute. Get you back on.
Okay. Okay, my
phone
or something.
You're still
breaking up.
Yeah, breaking up. Sound like you're done well.
And your picture is frozen.
Back to this. I'll come back in a few later.
Jim, you may want to call in on your phone.
Sometimes it helps to turn the video piece off too, Jim.
Not sure you can hear us.
I can hear you.
You want to try turning off your video, or maybe that's not possible?
My video is off. Not sure why I have a bad connection. You guys getting anything from them?
Yeah, you're still breaking up.
All right, let me just, I can hear you guys. Just go ahead. I'll have some comments later on.
Okay, any more discussion on the BPA post-2028 contracts?
None for me.
Okay. All right, so we're kind of running into a brick wall here with Ted. Let's move on to correspondence communication. Doug, do we have any?
Yeah, none today. Will.
All right. Let's do commissioner reports. Rick, well, Jim, you can lead it off. Kind of mix it up.
All right. I'll try. Am I coming in?
Yeah, you're better.
Okay. What I was going to say, a council member from Port Angeles called me last week, and he was asking about the provider choice contract process and everything, and he really didn't understand it, so I provided a brief him on that. But what I suggested was that, or to Doug, is that we invite Verstappen and Krasnick to participate in these conversations with us. Like to just
Jim, you're barely understandable.
Why don't you leave and come back in again, Jim. Yeah, I couldn't hear him at all.
No, I couldn't understand him. Yeah.
I could hear him, but I couldn't understand him.
No, exactly. Rick, you want to go ahead or?
Sure. I don't have a lot. I've just been to one BPA provider of choice meetings. I personally have been enjoying those. I think Bonneville's doing a good job of providing some background, and for folks that haven't been plugged into the utility industry for a while, that I'm finding their meetings to be very beneficial. But that's that was on the 10th, and that's the only meeting I've been to since the last board meeting.
Okay. Thanks, Rick. All right, well, I'll go ahead.
Can you hear me
back
now?
On?
Yeah, am I coming any better?
Yeah, that's loud and clear. Great. You want to redo that your previous discussion?
Sure, yes. I got a call from a city council member from Port Angeles, and he was trying to learn about the BPA's 2028 process, and so I briefed him on that, and he, you know, kind of was concerned about, you know, how this was, you know, he thought they didn't have to do anything for another 6 or 7 years. Anyway, I suggested to Doug that we invite maybe Greg King on their staff to these discussions that we're having every 2 weeks on this process and invite him to listen in and ask questions if he wants in order to help him get established since they've lost their utilities guy anyway. They're kind of shorthanded over there. The other thing, I got a call from some folks with the biochar outfit, and they talked about a biochar facility they want to build over on some land on the Mudd Elbach tribe. And the biochar process will result in power up to 10 megawatts. And
Jim, you're breaking up again.
All right, go ahead, Will. This isn't that critical.
Maybe if you talk slower, that might help. I don't know.
Jim, are you on your phone, or are you still trying to get in on your?
I think he zoomed back in, but he's having the same problems.
Yeah.
Maybe it would be good to get back on the phone. Although Ted looks like Ted's on, and I'm not sure whether he's going to have something to actually view on online.
Yeah, I'm here, and I can just start talking about the CPA, and I've got a few slides to share if you are ready.
Yeah, why don't we do that? We can go give Jim time to get back. I assume he can hear what's being said. Is that a good assumption or not?
He's trying to log back in right now, Will.
Well, let's give him a minute.
Okay, he's back in.
Ted sounds a little broken up too.
Jim, are you on, or I don't see him.
His audio is not on yet, Will.
This is the most problem we've had with a virtual meeting, I think.
A lot of static.
Yeah.
I think it might be Commissioner Waddell's connection.
Yeah.
Did you want Matthias to introduce Ted now, Will?
Yeah, we can do that. And I think we can, before Ted begins his presentation, we probably need to get Jim back on, though. So.
Yeah, maybe best for Jim to just do the video and then call in on the phone for the audio.
Yeah, I have to do that quite often with virtual meetings. Jim, can you hear?
He lost.
Yeah, so he's on my phone down.
Okay. Yeah.
Hey, Will, I'm on my phone now.
Ah, okay. Well, we'll go ahead and start Ted's presentation, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Yeah, so this is Matthias here again. So I just want to introduce Ted Light, who will be talking about the 2021 conservation potential assessment that we've been working with Ted on since December of last year. Ted works for Lighthouse Energy Consulting, which is a fairly new energy consulting outfit, but Ted has actually been involved in completion of our 2017-2019 CPAs when he worked for ES Consulting. So he does have some direct background into the work that he's going to be talking about. So I'll just hand it over to you, Ted, and be in the background if anybody needs anything or have any questions that I'm better suited to answering.
Can't hear you, Ted.
Ted, you're muted.
front. Can you all hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. There we go. My computer locked up for just a second. So can everybody see the slides that I'm sharing?
Yes.
Great. Okay. So as Matthias said, my name is Ted Light, and I'm actually the founder and sole employee of Lighthouse Energy Consulting. Started the company beginning of 2020, getting a jump start on working from home just a couple months before everybody else did with the pandemic. But as Matthias said, before that I was employed with EES Consulting, where I worked on the CPA for Clallam in 2017 and 2019. And beyond that, I've got a lot of experience in energy efficiency planning, working for the Energy Trust of Oregon early in my career. I also was part of a team that BPA hired to look at the energy efficiency and demand response material in the 2021 power plan put together by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. And I'm also a member of the Power Council's Conservation Resource Advisory Committee. So today I thought I'd talk to you, what is the conservation potential assessment? Some of you may have been around the last time I was here, but for anyone who's new and or forgot, we can do a brief refresher. And then I'll also talk about kind of the background, some of the kind of driving factors of this work. I'll cover kind of problems, historic targets and achievements, and then probably spend a good bit of time walking through some detail on some of the results. So let's start with what is a conservation potential assessment or CPA. So ultimately it looks to answer three questions. The first is how can Clallam PUD save energy, and then how much of that is possible. And then what is cost effective? So to think about, how and where it's possible to save energy, we look at energy efficiency measures across a range of sectors, residential, commercial, industrial, agriculture, and then even the utility distribution system. And within each of those sectors, we look at a variety of end uses, HVAC, water heating, lighting, et cetera. And then, to determine how much of that is possible, we'd say, okay, based on each of those energy efficiency measures, how many of them can we implement? If we look at customer characteristics, what are the characteristics of the individual homes? What are the equipment saturations? How many, electric versus gas versus propane heating systems are there? How many are heat pump, air source heat pump versus electric forced air furnace versus zonal. We also look at past achievements to understand, what's already been done and what's left. And then we also consider market barriers, both kind of the maturity of the markets for individual measures, just to know, how much can be saved in a given year, how quickly a market is moving to adopt a new technology. Also thinking about, what's possible for a program, knowing that, programs take time to develop and ramp up. Finally, with the cost effective question, we look at the cost and benefits of energy efficiency and compare those against the cost and benefits of alternative resources. As part of the state requirements that I'll talk about next, we look at the total cost of all these measures. So we include not just the incentive that Clallam PUD might pay, but we look at the whole measure cost, so the remaining cost that a participant in a program might pay, and compare those against the cost and benefits of alternative resources. So, we look at, what they'll save in terms of the value of the energy, what they save in terms of capacity on transmission and distribution systems, how they help Clallam PUD comply with state mandates for renewable energy and clean energy and so on. So those are the things we consider. I should say, please feel free to stop me along the way with questions. This is kind of another way to think about a CPA, and kind of a stair step of, you know, the kind of different kinds of potential that we think about. So we start off with everything that's technically possible. So, one energy conservation measure is duct sealing, so tightening the ducts on a ducted like heat pump, air source heat pump system. You can't do that on a home that doesn't have ducting, so that maybe has a zonal heating system. So we look to quantify everything that's technically possible, not counting measures where they're not possible or, you know, they've already been achieved. From there, we include market and adoption barriers.
Just a quick question. You mentioned the having duct system to accommodate heat pumps or whatever. What about ductless heat pumps? Is that included in there?
Yes, definitely. We did include ductless heat pumps in the analysis for, you know, for homes that have, you know, zonal heat and so on. So the second sort of stair step down is the achievable potential. That's where we incorporate the market barriers. And in that, you know, we include ramp rates that kind of determine the ramp of, you know, what program achievement looks like, knowing that, you know, as I said before, programs can't go from 0 to 60 and, you know, in a week. They take time to ramp up, and so, you know, we include that. We also looked at with the COVID-19 pandemic happening, we looked at, you know, impacts in terms of what's happening with programs and making sure we're setting realistic expectations with that. And then the last step there is the economic potential. And so there, again, we're screening to determine what measures are cost effective when compared against alternative resources. So background in terms of the requirements for the CPA, they primarily come from two different pieces of legislation. The first that we've been working under for a long time is the Energy Independence Act, and that stipulates that utilities in Washington have to come up with a two-year target for energy efficiency every 2 years. It has to be based on the CPA, and the Energy Independence Act has a whole page of requirements for what that CPA has to do and what has to be included in the methodology. In general, it has to follow the methodology that's used by the Northwest Power Council, but we do use column PUD specific inputs everywhere we can. Recently, as I'm sure many of you know, we've had the addition of the Clean Energy Transformation Act. And as part of that, in addition to the two-year target, we now also need a four-year target. And also based on a CPA that's included as part of the Utility Clean Energy Implementation Plan. I'm helping Clown with that as part of some separate work. And the other requirement from the Clean Energy Transformation Act that impacts CPAs is it requires the use of specific values for the social cost of carbon. So those in particular are the values determined by a federal interagency working group. We've used those as part of the CPA.
So Ted, the CPA for the Energy Independence Act, is that different than the CPA for the Clean Energy Transformation Act?
No, it's not. One CPA that meets both requirements.
Thank you.
So here's a history of those two-year targets. You can see in the solid gray line, you see the targets, and then in the dark blue color, you see the PUD's achievements, and then I've added a forecast that I got from Matthias a little while ago. I'm sure he's got more up-to-date information, but that's the things we're looking at when provided that. And if you're the kind that likes to skip to the end of the story, you can see the dashed line showing where the target is headed for this upcoming biennium. You can see, definitely a strong history of achievement, meeting the target every biennium. This slide breaks that achievement out into different sectors and breaks the biennium out into individual years. So you can see most of the achievement happens in the residential sector, that dark blue color. In addition, the light blue color, that's savings from the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. That's a group that coordinates market transformation initiatives across utilities in the Northwest. And most of their market transformation work is in the residential sector. So if you combine the dark blue and the light blue colors, you can see that most of the savings, as you might expect, in the common PUD service territories in the residential sector, followed by commercial savings in green and a little bit of industrial savings in the yellow color as well.
So maybe this is a question from Mathias, but why is the 2018 industrial so much greater than any previous or going forward year?
It's because we have one industrial customer, and they're sort of a little particular when they want to do energy efficiency projects. So a couple of years ago, they were really interested in LED lighting. So it's we helped them retrofit their area lighting. So they have some high 1,000-watt-hour halide poles that were changed out to LED.
Okay, thank you.
I'll add that across utilities, and industrial savings are lumpy. Even utilities that have a mix of industrial clients, it always depends. The industrial savings you get each year depend on what projects are happening, and whether you get really really great projects that year or a mix of smaller projects. So it's always kind of a bit of a roller coaster in the industrial sector. So here are the results for this 2021 CPA on an annual basis. Actually, let me go back here. So you can see the annual program achievements when you factor in CLOWN PUD program savings as well as the market transformation initiatives from NEA, kind of average right around the 6,000 megawatt hours a year mark. They're a little bit more in years prior and kind of hovering around that, and maybe a little bit less than in the recent years. So keep that kind of reference point in mind when we look at this annual potential here. You can see things start off around 2,500 megawatt hours a year, and over time, as the assumed market share ramps up in the early 2030s, get to a maximum, I think, of around maybe 9,000 or 10,000 megawatt hours per year. And then, once you kind of ramp up that market share of different energy efficiency measures, you start running out of opportunities, opportunities for retrofits and things like that start to decline. So you have a decrease in potential happening through the kind of the later part of the study period.
Ted?
Yes.
On this slide, you have utility. On the previous slide, you had distribution. I'm assuming that that's distribution from the utility savings?
Oh, yep. Yeah, those are the same. So utility here is the same. It's I think in my modeling, I call it the utility sector, but I think this data on the previous slide, I pulled it from what CLOWN PUD reports to the as part of the Energy Independence Act. I think they might call it distribution there, but it is all the same to answer your question. It's your savings available through what's called conservation voltage reduction in the utility distribution system.
Thank you.
Good question. So similar to kind of past achievements, you know, most of the potential is in the residential sector, and then with lesser amounts in the commercial and industrial sectors.
And Ted, where do you, in the residential sector, where do you see, I mean, that looks to me like quite a few megawatt hours that you're identifying there. And since I don't think that that's going to be in lighting, is that mostly in heating, or where do you see that?
Yeah, good question. Give me just a couple slides and we'll get into all that.
Okay, thank you.
So I guess the first part I want to address is, you know, there's definitely a difference from going from around 6,000 megawatt hours a year to, you know, starting around 2,500. So what's driving that difference? So this table has a bunch of numbers on it. We'll kind of talk through some of the key ones here. So what I have is, you know, comparisons of the 2-year potential, the 10-year potential, and the 20-year potential between the 2019 CPA, the previous CPA, and this one, the 2021 CPA, and the percent change. You can see between the commercial and industrial, commercial, residential, and agriculture sectors, you see there are decreases in the near term, with, and in general, increases overall in the long term. And similar to your question, Rick, you know, about kind of what's included in, you know, definitely with the state standard in Washington recently passed, you know, that mandates, basically mandates LEDs for a lot of lighting technologies, and also has standards for shower heads and aerators and other technologies. There's kind of a shift going on. And so there's less lighting, there's less potential in the areas that, you know, a lot of energy efficiency programs have kind of historically used as their bread and butter measures. But there's other potential that's being identified, like heat pump water heaters, but that potential takes a little bit more time. The market's a little bit younger. It's still kind of a new technology to a lot of people. And it also depends on equipment turning over. Whereas a lot of people are willing to replace a light before it burns out for a more efficient one, most people aren't going to replace their water heater unless it's, you know, leaking or otherwise near the end of its life. So it takes a little bit more time to implement some of those measures that depend on those equipment turnover cycles. So that's kind of a key thing that's happening across a lot of these sectors, is you got a little bit less potential in the early years because we're shifting to kind of some measures that are a little bit slower in terms of what programs can do and how quickly they can be adopted.
Well, the biggest area of growth seems to be in distribution. So I'm assuming that we're targeting using lower voltages to deliver?
Yeah, exactly. That's the utility or distribution sector, that is regulating voltage to deliver a slightly lower voltage, but still kind of within a tolerable band. And for that one, the increase is based on kind of some new methodology. The Power Council worked with BPA to update their estimates of the cost and savings of those measures. And so the potential in there increased a pretty significant amount, but, you know, in terms of the grand scheme of things, it's, you know, increasing from a relatively small amount. And it's still a fairly minor piece of the overall potential.
I'm assuming that this does not require new transformers.
No, hey, Rick, this is John. So basically, CVR is something we've done on several substations. And our CVR program basically puts end-of-line monitoring of voltage, actual PTs near end-of-line, where we actively monitor the voltage and we adjust station regulation, where we generally lower the voltage, on a 120 base as much as 3 volts. And with a CVR factor of about 0.45, that gives us, 1.2, 1.3 energy reduction, and it's pretty much automatic. About 90% of the reduction in energy is savings on the customer side, where they use less energy, and we also get some advantage of reductions in line losses and primarily transformer no-load losses due to operating distribution transformers at a lower voltage. And we've done Sunland Substation, we've done Blend Substation, we've done Olympic Substation, and we're working on Agnew and Monroe Stations now and next. So it's pretty predictable, and our results on those substations fall in line with the Power Council's analysis.
Thank you, John.
John, does this follow the AMI system?
Yeah, well, what we want to do, and one of the reasons we're kind of holding off a little bit on, or at least slowed down the projects, one reason is the actual intellectual limitations, staffing shortages in engineering, but we have the know-how within engineering to do this. But we also want to investigate, instead of actually installing primary PTs on near the end of line, to actually utilize the AMI system where we have a lot more data points to do essentially the same thing. And that is almost basically a freebie where we don't have to install as much hardware. But that's something we're going to be looking into over the next few years as AMI is deployed.
Thank you.
So just if you're kind of curious if these results are consistent with what I'm seeing across some of my other clients, I have column PV here in this circled area, and I have the 2, 10, and 20-year potential in the blue, dark blue, light blue, and yellow colors. You can see that, while results from utility to utility vary a little bit, kind of the overall theme is the same, kind of a decrease in the near-term potential, kind of following that shift from measures, as well as, a lot of programs saw a little bit of a turn back with COVID-19 impacts, especially in the commercial sector. And then increases in potential in the longer term with some of the new measures that were added that are based on kind of the equipment turnover cycles that take a little bit more time. So we're seeing similar results in terms of the changes. And then I also looked at the 20-year potential as a share of the overall load in the 20th year. And so Crown PV is just under 20%, in line with kind of what I've seen from some of my other clients and the results that I'm seeing there. We'll add that all these results are drafts. Things do change. So now I'll get into some of the individual results for individual sectors, covering the results at an end-use level, and then also looking one level deeper at some of the kind of key measure categories. So within the residential sector, kind of the main area, you can see that most of the savings are in this HVAC and water heating categories. The HVAC category, I will add, does include both HVAC equipment, like ductless heat pumps, smart thermostats, things like that, as well as weatherization measures as well, so attic insulation, things like that. If you lighting, there is still some potential. A lot of the remaining potential we'll see in that is coming from slightly different technologies that you'll see. The smaller amounts of savings coming from appliances, electronics, and a little bit from a few other categories.
Ted, I am a little surprised to see. I would have assumed that lighting would be the potential savings there would decrease significantly going forward. And according to this graph, it looks pretty consistent or constant through 2031. I'm not sure I understand that.
Yeah, it's a good question. So a lot of the lighting potential is in often referred to as integrated LED fixtures. So rather than replacing a light bulb within an existing fixture, you're replacing the whole fixture, and it has integrated LEDs. You're not changing a bulb when it burns out. You've got a whole fixture, and so those take time. Those aren't things that when a bulb goes out, you replace it, and it's also something that requires a little bit more. We'll say it this way, maybe the market's still pretty young for that. There's not a lot of consumer familiarity with those fixtures, and it also maybe takes level two DIY skills to have the comfort of changing a whole fixture as opposed to changing a light bulb. So instead of what we may have seen in the past with, let's get lots of lighting savings early and see that taper down through the 20 years, the kind of assumed projection here is a little bit more even. Like, these will take a little bit more time to get familiarity, to get them installed, things like that. There is still some potential in lamps. Actually, let me take a step back. I think I jumped a step here. So this graph is what's called a tree map. And the area in each square, each rectangle, represents the share of the 10-year potential within each category. So we have HVAC, water heating, lighting, and then within kind of the measure group within that. So the area of this box here represents the share of potential, the 10-year potential for LED fixtures as compared to the whole 10-year potential across the residential sector. So you can see most of the lighting potential is in these fixtures. There's still some potential in some LED lamps, but the baseline has increased on that.
Ted, this is Doug. Let me ask a question on the heat pump water heaters. Right now, I believe it's water heaters above 80 gallons that have to be heat pump based. Is this increase in heat water, HP water heaters based on the fact that more 80 gallon water heaters will be going in, or based on maybe a guesstimate that, or maybe regulations are going to go down to 50 gallons and lower also?
I forget, actually. Matthias might have to remind me about the standard for heat pump water heaters, but I can't remember where that one left off. But I think the main reason we're seeing heat pump water heaters be the majority of the water heating potential is just that there aren't a lot of measures left in the water heating category. The recent state standards in Washington now apply to shower heads and aerators, so those measures are removed. And also, I shifted, I think maybe in the past, the clothes washer measure might have been included in the water heating category. I shifted that to the appliance category because I thought that maybe that made more sense there. But really kind of the only main other measure is this TFRV, which stands for thermostatic restrictor valve, and that's something you can add to your shower or bathtub where, you know, if you start the water and you walk away while it gets, the water gets hot, this will actually sense when that water is heated up and you know, turn the water down to a trickle once it gets hot so that you're not wasting water and water heats at that point. So it's really, I think, probably the main reason heat pump water heaters are the main measure in this category is kind of just a lot of the potential from other measures that's shifted away. Matthias, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, no, like off the top of my head, I'm not familiar with that 80-gallon requirement you're referring to, Doug, so, and I will look into that. What I can say, though, is the majority of the heat pump water heaters that we pay for through our program are smaller than that, is 40 and 50-gallon water heaters. And currently, we get about half the heat pump water heaters we pay for in new construction applications, where it's not a requirement that you put in a heat pump water heater, because otherwise, in general, in new construction, you know, we're not going to pay a rebate for something that the energy code require you to do anyways. But the way the state has set it up with water heating is you get an extra point if you use the heat pump water heater. And then there's a certain amount of points that you need to get as well as part of your energy code application, you know, with a number of other items listed. And I think a lot of builders have figured out that they can get that point and get a rebate. So it's sort of advantageous for them. We don't really promote that per se. You know, really most of our effort with heat pump water heaters currently is to form relationship with plumbers who do retrofit applications, because that's where the real energy savings are as far as we're concerned. But since this, you know, since these builders are doing it and it's a, you know, fairly straightforward way for us to get energy savings that meet BPAs and the EIA requirements, we figure we offer that as well.
Okay, thank you.
So just a few more words on this slide. You can see, you know, in the HVAC category, you know, thermostats are kind of the biggest area of potential, followed by ductless heat pumps and duct sealing. Weatherization and air source heat pumps, whether it's a primary source of savings in the past, due to some changes in the CPA, the potential, the cost-effective potential in those has been really limited. The savings and costs for those were updated as part of the 2021 plan from the Power Council. And so a lot of those measures did not pass the cost effectiveness screen. So it's kind of only certain instances, you know, certain your existing installation levels and things like that we looked at with weatherization, air source heat pumps, that ended up being cost effective. So while that doesn't mean that Carlo and Matthias have to stop running their programs, it does kind of maybe give a warning light maybe that some of those measures and depending on how BPA looks at them in the future, there might be some challenges with cost effectiveness in the future. Any other questions on this slide? So moving on to the commercial sector, here most of the potential is in the lighting category, even though this has been kind of a mainstay of the commercial programs across the region for a while. There's still plenty left to do, but you do see over time things starting to turn down. Refrigeration and HVAC measures are also key areas here, but you know those are areas where it takes a little bit more time. Not everybody's ready to sign up for a retrofit of their HVAC system next week. And similarly with refrigeration, there some of the measures that we included in that assessment are kind of newer technologies. And so it's going to take time for some of those to kind of work their way through and be implemented. Similar slide here showing kind of the breakdown of 10-year potential into the different end uses and measure categories. As you can see, so lighting is the still the key, and you know, most of that lighting, as you would expect, is in interior lighting, but it's additional potential in street lighting, exterior lighting, and a few other areas. In the refrigeration end use, most of that potential is in grocery refrigeration systems, and then some other smaller systems like ice makers, vending machines, and water coolers. In the HVAC end use, you can really see that you know, a lot of commercial buildings vary from one building to the other and the different systems they use. So the potential here is broken out into, you know, the range of different systems that you come across in commercial buildings. There's also, you can see the font here in the square, there's windows, there's some new window measures that we looked at as well. I think similarly, some of those were quite expensive and may take some time before those become mainstream. Other measures, servers here, that's servers as part of kind of server closets, you know, in embedded data centers you might find in offices and such, not the big data centers you see in Eastern Washington or Eastern Oregon. Some of the new measures that I mentioned earlier are different motor-driven system measures, including fans and pumps. So you can see that, you know, those systems, when you look at those in combination, add a pretty significant amount of potential together. But those are the measures that do take time to implement because they're again based on equipment replacement cycles. So here's the industrial sector breakdown by end use. Here, kind of the biggest source of potential in the long term is this all electric category. And what's included in that is the strategic energy management. But as Matthias mentioned, there's one big industrial facility in the service territory, and you know, it'll take time for that to be implemented. Lighting is the other big key end use, and you know, that one, you know, programs are doing pretty well as with the commercial sector, and so you see the potential start to decline for that end use, and then see kind of the variety of other industrial end uses going up from there, including material handling, compressed air, fans, again, that motor-driven system, new measure area. Any questions on this or commercial on the previous slide? So to wrap things up, for this CPA, we've identified a two-year target of just shy of 5,000 megawatt hours, and a four-year target of 12,300 megawatt hours for the CEIP, the Clean Energy Implementation Plan, as part of the CETA. And again, kind of the story behind those are, you know, a lower near-term potential due to lower avoided costs, some updated measure costs and savings that challenge the cost effectiveness of some measures. The product standards for Washington for lighting and shower heads, as well as the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, kind of limiting what programs are doing in the current timeline. However, in the longer term, there are some new measures, but it'll take more time for those to be adopted. So that's all I have. If there are any other questions, if other questions come up, feel free to reach out via email or phone.
Okay, thanks, Ted. That was very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is Matthias here again. So if I don't need to rush anything, if you have any more questions or want to consider some more, certainly you should do that. Otherwise, we have a resolution prepared, hoping that you will vote to establish a 10-year potential, covering the time period 2022 to 2031, as well as the conservation target for 2022-23. There's one slight difference in this resolution. Historically, we've done the CPAs and established targets in units in average megawatts, because that's what the Power Council does. But Department of Commerce requires us to report in megawatt hours, so we made a decision to do the CPA as well as the resolution in megawatt hours. It is just a change of units, really.
Matthias, do you have a presentation to go with this, or we got all the information we need?
Yeah, Ted's presentation is really the meat of it, so I don't have any additional things to say.
Okay, then we'll move on to Resolution 2209-21.
I move that we accept a resolution. Unless, Jim, do you have any questions, or Will?
No, I'm good.
I move that we accept Resolution 2209-21 establishing the District's 2022 through 2031 achievable cost-effective conservation potential and 2022 through 2023 biennial conservation target. That was a mouthful.
Yeah. Jim, are you still there?
He is, Will, but I see that his phone is muted. Jim, if you're on your phone, you might have to push *6 to unmute.
How about that?
Yeah.
Okay, there we go. I'll second the motion.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 2209-21, establishing the district's 2022 through 2031 achievable cost-effective conservation potential and 2022 to 2023 biennial conservation targets. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All right, good. All right, thank you, Matthias. Thanks, Ted. Why don't we take a 5-minute break, then we'll come back and finish commissioner reports and move on to staff reports. 5 minutes. Make that 2:57, I guess.
Hey, Will, are you hearing me now?
Yeah, we hear you.
Sounds okay.
Yeah, sounds good. Everybody back on. We'll go ahead then. Jim, did you want to finish your commissioner report?
I'm sure it'll stop about halfway through. the last thing I had was I forget the guy's name, with the biochar outfit here that wants to set up a biochar plant on some Elwha property out on the west side here. He's been in a lot of discussions with our staff and BPA, and so I just, you know, kind of passed that ball on to John and company and so forth to look at this potential opportunity. They have a potential to produce about 10 or 12 megawatts of power. And so the question, a lot of technical issues with us and BPA, so they're all working through that. But it's one of those things that looks like a possibly a great opportunity for, you know, for further resilience and reliability out this way, as long as all the everything pencils out and the technology and so forth works. That's all I have.
We have a meeting set up for them on Monday with Sean and John and myself and the two of them. So we can give you an update next time around.
Okay, thanks.
On that issue, it's going to be interesting to see how we manage the risk associated with potentially having to re-register with NERC and the Electric Reliability Organization. Because I believe there would be four registrations that we would have to sign up for, a DP, LSC, TO, and potentially TOP. Is that right, John?
Yeah, so, Rick, we've already made an inquiry with our attorney, who's well-versed in NERC registration. Our initial read is if they serve local load, there's no way we have to re-register. If they do intend to export, and we will through our transmission and BPA wills it to a faraway customer, we're not certain one way or the other. It depends on how you interpret the registration requirements. If we do have to register, we'll have to register in four categories in all likelihood, but we already have that inquiry to the attorneys to get a definitive answer, hopefully here within a week or so.
Great. Thank you, John.
What that project, as I understand it, they're going to use biofuels and produce carbon black, I guess. Is that what that project really is? Or do we know?
Yeah, it's a biochar process, which is not exactly carbon black, but it makes the biochar basically, when it's treated properly, as a fertilizer.
Okay.
One of the byproducts is they're going to have extra gas heat energy that they can turn a turbine and produce that. It was a little surprising to me to hear that it was being proposed because the biochar that I got briefed on a few years ago seemed to not quite pencil out. And also, you know, it almost sounds like a free lunch kind of situation where you can basically take all this waste wood and somehow you end up with fertilizer and surplus power. So anyway, it's always it's good to make sure they've got their pencils really sharp and they're not externalizing cost that they should otherwise include in this thing. Like, what is their fuel source and how reliable is that?
Sounds like perpetual motion.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Okay, if we're done with that, I'll give my commissioner report. At a meeting of the Resource Adequacy Task Force, and the Northwest Power Pool Resource Adequacy Movement, they had a symposium on August the 4th, and their first phase operational period is now is non-binding, but it's moving forward. John Hairston participated in that, members of the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, and a bunch of utility execs, both executives, both public and IOUs. The theme was that talking about the uncertainty, weather, fires, carbon legislation, and electrification. One of the takeaways was that transmission is a major issue that is going to be a problem with resource adequacy, and so that's been identified. And just getting delivery of firm, and the operative term there is firm carbon-free resources. Coordination is required between public power versus the IOU. They have different focuses, different requirements, of course, nonprofit versus profit. The Northwest Power and Conservation Council is seeing a lot of solar, but no batteries. There doesn't seem to be an appetite to back up the solar. Their model, which we've talked about before, they say it's aligned right now, but it's very sensitive, whatever that means. Looking out over 20 years, their model includes some natural gas because natural gas is going to be phased out during that 20-year period. And so that kind of skews their results. BPA has made a commitment to resource adequacy, but will limit participation in the EIM, they think. And there's no BPA decision on that except for load-following utilities. We also talked about the new solar farm, Ruby Flats, which is a 150-megawatt facility built on Energy Northwest land. There's been a lease agreement that will net Energy Northwest about $125,000 per year, and the developers already bought an option for that. For the solar farm Ruby Flats, BPA interconnection will be complete in 1 year. Construction will be completed by August in 2022. They're presently going out with purchase power agreements, mainly focused on public power utilities. But and so far, the NRU, the Northwest Requirements Utilities, are one of the major subscribers to that. They anticipate it'll be oversubscribed, but if it's not, they'll open it up to IOUs. Solar components, there was also a discussion about that solar power complements the irrigation loads in July and August. So that's a good thing. Energy Northwest will do the O&M on that solar farm. They think it'll only be about a half an FTE per year. They have the capability of adding storage, but right now there's no interest in doing so from the participants or the potential participants. Also, talk about aggregation services. Energy Northwest has looked at providing that for some time now. They're collecting data. But utilities that are participating in providing data, they're only two utilities so far, and they want that information to be kept confidential, so we're honoring that. And of course, mainly slicers and their own generators will be interested in aggregation services. As far as the new nuke, grant PUD focuses on the feasibility process. They've hired ex-Energy, Department of Energy person at Energy Northwest to follow those feasibility process. Technology and siting is the main focus of that feasibility thing, although they, if you recall, Grant has signed memos of understanding with both NuScale and with ex-Energy. They more recently signed another memo of understanding with, I think, NuScale to operate any new nuclear, which is kind of confusing because Energy Northwest also has a memo of understanding with a grant for that service. The big issue right now is expandability. They're looking at 12 reactors. There's licensing risk, whether or not you have to go to a public referendum to site something over, I think it's 350 megawatts. And, of course, Energy Northwest is touting their Site 1, which is right next to Columbia. It's already licensed for nuclear activity, but and they're in the process of monetizing that advantage over alternate sites. Right now, the biggest license risk for X Energy is their fuel design. That's going through NRC at the moment. It should be okay since they have no meltdown potential, no risk of escape of radiation to the atmosphere, but it has to be demonstrated to the NRC satisfaction. The other thing is environmental review. They will schedule public meetings to talk about that. And right now, one of the major risks in getting public acceptance is the tribes, so there's concentration on that. The Union of Concerned Scientists have come out against small modular reactors, saying they're not economically viable. But and public support, of course, is another risk. Grant will reach a decision on going forward with the project by 2025. And they're looking for off-takers. What they're going to do is they're going to install these alternate nuclear facilities and then look for power sales agreements with off-takers. TerraPower, which is Bill Gates' company with their, as you remember, they were looking at Site 1 there at Energy Northwest. Then they moved over to a shutdown coal plant in Wyoming. So they're still talking to Energy Northwest to support that effort with technology assessment and perhaps moving into an O&M type of thing. But there's some concern about moving way outside, well, outside the Northwest for Energy Northwest. I talked about the extended power uprate. We're going to look at final numbers, schedule, and so on. There will be a half-day session this week, and the executive board will give direction on going forward. I guess that's all I have. Any questions, comments?
Yeah, I do. Earlier in your comments, I think you were talking about the BPA RA program or the RA program that BPA is looking at, and you said the model was, you know, indicated solar but not battery.
No, that's Northwest Power and Conservation Council's model.
It does have battery in it. As of a week or two ago.
Well, you know, the alternative, well, it also has natural gas in there. So what they're talking about is, I guess, you can back up solar with natural gas until that is no longer viable or no longer allowed. And so that's in the model, which is kind of skewing the results we're seeing from their model.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit more involved than that, but okay, I better understand what you meant now. Oh, and one thing speaking of the council, today they voted on releasing their draft power plan today. And so it's as soon as they get it set up on the website so that the public can access it, public comment period will be 60 days. And so we need to talk to WAPAG and folks like that and figure out, okay, who's going to take a look at this thing, because it's a couple hundred pages long and it's got a lot of supporting documents. You know, I'll be looking at it, but, you know, I not really my job, so to speak. Anyway, that's that. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Okay, move.
Along those lines, before you end there, I'll be real quick. You know, the council has really been having a lot of trouble with their model lately, to the point where a lot of folks aren't really sure that it's providing consistent and viable results. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out in the future.
Yeah, that comment that was made by the Northwest Power Council staff was that they think the model is aligned, but it's very sensitive, whatever that means. So. Okay, let's move on to staff reports. First one is the 2014 bond discussion by Sean.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. I've been talking to Dick Schober with Piper Sandler, who's our underwriter for issuing bonds. And the district is in kind of a unique opportunity to take advantage of some historically low interest rates through some strategic financing. So right now we currently have some 2014 bonds on the books at a coupon rate of 5%, but they're not callable until 2024. And through what's called the defeasance process, we can take current district monies equal to the amount to pay off the bonds, which we then place in an escrow account for U.S. Bank, and thereby remove the debt obligation from our balance sheet. When the bonds become callable in 24, U.S. Bank would then release the money and pay the debt in full, but for practical reasons, once the district places the money to cover the bonds in escrow, they're paid in full and defeased. So since that would be such a large outflow of cash, we're recommending that we utilize monies in our rate stabilization fund and our CETA capital fund to proceed forward with the defeasance. And then to fund future capital projects, we would issue new bonds in 2021 at a lower interest rate. And the numbers I've gotten from Dick would be an expected all-in cost of about 1.75%. So through defeasing the 2014 bonds and a new issuance, it would save the district approximately $1.8 million in a net present value savings. And so once we issue the new 21 bonds and the district completes capital projects that are eligible, we would reimburse the operating account, and then we would build back up our CETA and rate stabilization accounts within a projected amount of time of 18 months. And so with the CETA battery project not really viable until 25 or potentially beyond, this would make a great opportunity to use those funds for this opportunity. So the cash flow savings on an annual basis isn't really significant until the 2014 bonds are callable, which is in 24. So from 25 to 34, the yearly cash flow savings would be about $260,000 per year. And in the interim, 22 to 24, prior to the call date, the savings would be right around $100,000, which would help mitigate, you know, some increases that we're seeing, inflation, some state-mandated long-term care that we discussed at the last meeting, and basically just help ensure that, you know, we continue down the path of the low inflationary rate increases that we proposed at the last meeting. So at this point, we've been in discussion with Nancy Nearest, who's our attorney for issuing bonds, along with Dick over at Piper Sandler. And the plan would be to come to you all in late September, probably the second meeting in September, with a resolution to proceed forward with the defeasance process and then issuing new bonds in 21. So I know that's a lot to take in, and I probably didn't do a good job explaining it. If you're confused, I can go over it again.
Well, Sean, I have a question about once we put that money in the bank, do we still continue to make payments?
No. Okay. So once the money goes into the bank, U.S. Bank will then make the yearly debt service payments through 24, and then in 24, U.S. Bank will release the money to pay the bonds in full when they become callable. That's why when we issue the new bonds, there is a small cash flow savings between 22 and 24, about $100,000 per year. But then beyond that, it's about $260,000 per year.
Makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Diluted way of refinancing. That's okay. Excuse me, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I guess what we're looking for is you know, giving you this information, but then looking for kind of a nod that we can put in the minutes that we can look into it further and proceed along this line.
Well, I'm nodding.
I'm nodding.
Yeah, so we'll come back in September with it's called a bond resolution, and it's basically the beginning stages of this process.
Everybody, I thought I saw Jim talking, but he's muted.
Oh, it does look like Jim muted.
Jim, you're muted.
Sorry about that.
There you go.
I would like to see what actually the impact you're talking about in terms of the battery project that we had set up. And because you're talking about basically utilizing that account to set this up.
Right. So the money that we have set aside in the CETA battery project, we would utilize for this defeasance. And then within 18 months, we would reimburse that account for the full amount that we took out. So we would still be on track for the battery project in 25.
Is that when we originally proposed that it be done?
We had a kind of a window, and I believe it was between 24 and 26 would be the time of the project.
Okay. That's
okay.
Fine, then.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Commissioners. And like I said, I'll come back with more information in September when we have a resolution to present.
Good job, Sean.
Yeah, good job. That's kind of convoluted, but sounds like a good piece of business.
Yes.
T, do we have any action items?
No, sir, we do not have any action items.
You have one more staff report, Will, for Terry Lynn.
Oh, I'm sorry. My goodness. Sorry, Terry. Go
There's
ahead.
No problem. No problem. Good afternoon, guys. I'm here today to ask the board to consider a modification to our standard operating procedure for board authorization to go to bids for some purchases. The problem that we're having is we're experiencing long lead times for delivery of some vehicles, equipment, and materials, especially large vehicles and some substation equipment. For vehicles and equipment in the past, we've come to the board and asked for approval to seek bids in January, after the budget is approved. Once we receive the bids and evaluate for the best one, we come back to the board for permission to proceed with the purchase. A PO is then created and we order the equipment in March. That's when we make a financial commitment and enter into a contract to purchase. Delivery times have gotten much longer over the last few years, well over a year for bucket trucks and digger derricks, for example. With manufacturing and labor shortages, we anticipate and have been warned about even longer lead times in 2022. We're looking for ways to reduce that delivery time, and one way to help accomplish that is to start the bid process earlier. If we were able to come to the board seeking authorization to begin our bid process in mid-October, before budget line items are approved, we could, without any monetary or contractual commitments, have the bid process completed. Then we would ask for board authorization to proceed to purchase and be prepared to cut the PO. We would then be ready to order equipment in January when funds are board approved and available for the 2022 budget. This will put us ahead of many other equipment buyers, giving us an earlier spot on production lines and saving money by securing pricing earlier. I'd like to say again that I'm not suggesting committing to money or contracts until after the final budget has been approved. If a product, vehicle, or a piece of equipment needed to be cut from the budget before final approval, we have only secured a bid and have not committed financially or contractually. We could simply not move forward with the purchase. So, in conclusion, I'm asking the board to consider giving staff the okay to begin the bid process as early as mid-October 2021 in preparation of getting budget line items ordered in early January 2022. And for this to be our practice for long lead times moving forward. Thanks. Are there any questions?
So I wouldn't anticipate that we would go out for bids and then not follow through with purchase, even though it will be delayed till the budget approval. But are we going to lose some credibility with bidders if that should happen?
You know, I don't think so. We're not the only ones experiencing these problems. I've been approached by many of the manufacturers of these vehicles, and they're trying to talk us into ways to get our bids in earlier. And this seems like the natural, you know, in a public entity like ours, you know, is to start the bidding sooner, knowing that we can't spend the money until that's got its final approval. And so some of this was suggested by, you know, by other utilities that I talked to and also by some of the manufacturers to help reduce our lead times.
Well, this is John. Historically, we bought many, many vehicles over the last, decades, and it is very rare for something to be cut out of the budget, usually due to very adverse budgetary constraints, which we do not anticipate for any time in the foreseeable future. So there is a small risk, but the potential with respect to getting equipment when we need it and can use it, as well as the savings, probably far outweigh that very small, minute risk.
Yeah, I was just going to weigh in, too. So I get a 10-year budget from the auto shop every year that includes all of the vehicles, and my preference would be to follow Terry's plan just because it's nice to spend the money that you budgeted in the year that you budgeted it. Otherwise, we're going to be outstanding with line item budgets for 22, they're going to carry over into 23, and it's just going to be a perpetual issue moving forward. So if it's okay with the board, I would recommend Terry's proposal.
Okay. Sounds logical. I'm nodding.
I'm nodding.
I have one question. Okay, so would we go ahead and get sort of a requirements briefing, in October? So when Terry puts together the bid, we're the commissioners are getting some sort of little brief on, yes, we're going to put in a bid for this particular piece of equipment so that we're not surprised in January or February when, we're dealing with the budget.
Yes, exactly. So what I'd like to do is instead of coming back to you in January and asking to go to bid, I'd like to get a nod from you guys that I could come in and say mid-October of 2021. Months earlier, and get permission from you to go out and get those bids.
Yeah, as long as you give us the rationale and why we're doing it and so forth like that. That sounds good.
Okay, so we're in agreement on that.
Good job, Terry. That's a good idea.
Yeah,
thank you guys.
Yeah,
thank
that's
you
great. Thanks for researching that. That's great. We're going to move up comments from the public, comments from the public. So any public out there, Sean, that have questions?
Again, nothing in the chat, but if anybody from the public would like to make a comment, please go ahead and give me your name now, and we'll get you on the list. Hearing none again, Will.
Okay, good. Well, at this point, we're going to recess our normal meeting and go into executive session, talk about the performance of a public employee. According to RCWs, I'm thinking 30 minutes or so. Anybody agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, 30 minutes then. And
give me just a second, and I'll get it set up for you, Will.
Okay. I don't think there's going to be any decisions. Well, there'll be no decisions made in executive session, but then we'll come out of executive session and probably no decisions, but we'll reconvene and talk about that.
Okay. It looks like everybody is back in, Will.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Just an announcement of what we were talking about in executive session, not to repeat the discussion, but Doug Nash has given us his retirement letter with his last day as general manager being January the 15th, 2022. So anyway, we've got some deliberations on what to do next, and we'll do that in future executive sessions. Biological terrorist attack in D.C. We've got some background noise there.
Radio.
Yeah. Okay, if that's no other business to come before the board, we stand adjourned.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Doug.
Thanks.